You're listening to Ave Maria Radio 990 WDEO Ypsilanti, Detroit. The FCC requires us to reduce our power at sunset. For those affected by this change, we invite you to listen on the internet at AveMariaRadio.net.
Good afternoon, I'm Al Cresta. We continue counting down the top interviews and commentaries and discussions of 2019. And let me tell you, we began at number 35, where Dr. Bill Cook talked to us about the fire at the Cathedral of Notre Dame and, again, the history of cathedrals. We talked with Dr. Lawrence Mead about the burdens of freedom and how American understanding of the individual is almost unique, even in the West. We talked with Joby Warrick about the end of ISIS and Mary Rice Hassan at the problems in the public schools and why she's urging us to get out now. Number 30 was Dr. Thomas Kidd, an overview of American religious history. Number 29, we had Sister Mary Gianna, who came to faith in Christ through her terrible experience of the massacre at Columbine High School back in 1999. Father John Bartunek looked at that phrase, I'm spiritual, not religious, and pointed out how that can be a wonderful entry for evangelization. We'll talk to Kathy Long about the Amazon conference, or the backdrop to the Amazon conference, and the mission to Amazonian peoples. Ed Sree joined us on Christmas Day about rethinking the Blessed Virgin Mary in the New Testament, and Dr. John Bergsma at number 25 talked to us about the Jewish roots of the Christian faith as seen through the Dead Sea Scrolls. On the Feast of St. Stephen, the day after Christmas, Steve Ray joined us with an overview of the life and martyrdom of St. Stephen. Kathy Kalina joined us at number 23, sharing with us her work as a midwife for souls. Sam Gregg on reason, faith, and the struggle for Western civilization. And at number 20, Leah Labresco joined us with her testimony story of coming to faith in Christ from being a flat-footed atheist. Surab Amari had a mild Muslim background, but he eventually came to understand the teaching of the Catholic Church and came into full communion. That was number 19. And then we started with a commentary that I gave on my experience of visiting Auschwitz and Birkenau. Mary Grace Tucker at number 17 shared her testimony of being pregnant out of wedlock and how she was surprised by the grace, good humor, and love of her parents and friends and all those she was with at Christendom College. Richard Watts joined us on, how not to spoil your kids in spite of great wealth. Tim Carney at number 15 looked at an alienated America and the election of Donald Trump. Father Roger Landry gave us a profile of the life of Blessed James Miller. Dan Mahoney looked at what he called the idol of our age, the religion of humanity. I gave a commentary on how Michael Jackson lost his humanity and became mere commodity. Sarah Williams shared with us her 9 months with Carrion. And then Janet Monday began the top 10, talking about the Ohio nurses who wanted physician-assisted suicide and how they are out of step with nurses generally. Number 9, Marianne Glendon on human rights and religious liberty around the world. I shared my experience in Poland. James K. A. Smith talking to us about St. Augustine's appropriateness for the modern age. And then number 6, Tim Glinkowski on renewing parish culture. Gerald McDermott on stuttering. And Moses, Mary Eberstadt now, on primal scream and identity politics. And then Dr. Wes Ely with us at number 3, when a patient asks, Doc, can you help me die? So let's go there at number 4 with Mary Eberstadt.
The best.
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 Best. Best.
Of Cresta in the Afternoon Countdown.
Number 4.
Good afternoon, I'm Al Cresta. My guest, Dr. Mary Eberstadt, is the author most recently of Primal Screams, How the Sexual Revolution Created Identity Politics. She's a senior fellow at the Faith and Reason Institute in Washington, D.C. Our previous books include How the West Really Lost God, A New Theory of Secularization, and a number of others. Mary has been with us a number of times in the past and has demonstrated just outstanding insight into the problems that we face in trying to live faithfully in our generation. And she begins this book, Primal Screams, How the Sexual Revolution Created Identity Politics, with the lone wolf, the myth of the lone wolf. I have to say, that took me by surprise, Mary.
Well, thank you, Al. So nice to be here again.
Well, thank you. Let's talk about the myth of the lone wolf and why it's an appropriate beginning to this book.
Well, I opened with that story for a reason, and it's a theme that comes up throughout the book, that human beings are social animals, and we sometimes think that we can be atomized and on our own without deleterious consequences following from that. Take the example of the lone wolf. Everybody thinks there is such a thing, but it turns out that scientists have researched the subject, and there isn't, because wolves are social creatures. All mammals are social creatures. And so in the book, I intersperse the argument with some of these examples drawn from behavioral science about what happens to social animals when they try to exist in isolation from one another. And what happens, I think, is what we're seeing now, which is social breakdown.
Yeah.
In the case of Homo sapiens, on a truly frightening scale.
Longevity has diminished over the last four times that we've analyzed it. You have the breakup of the idea of citizenship and the replacement of citizenship with the idea of victimhood and identity politics. And there are a lot of people now talking about, quote, civil war, not so much a regional, well, not necessarily a regional problem, but certainly an ideological problem in America. Have you ever seen it this divided before?
No, and I think I would be in a majority here arguing that we've never been as divided as we are. The decline in life expectancy is a truly shocking measure of what's happening out there. And there are other indices, too, like the ones that you mentioned. So what I'm trying to do in this book is say, what is really at the root cause of this?
Mm-hmm.
You know, we argue about politics, and people talk about the president and Republicans versus Democrats. But my argument is that the root cause is actually more fundamental than contemporary politics. The root cause of our problems is that the family has imploded, and people are existing in isolation on a scale that didn't exist before. And in the book, I have a number of examples of this, as you know. There's the explosion of loneliness studies, loneliness among the elderly.
Yeah.
And during the past few weeks alone, there have been numerous references to new studies suggesting that millennials and young people are lonelier than ever before. So again, in the book, I connect these sorts of very contemporary issues to the sexual revolution and the way in which it scattered the human family. Families are smaller. Some people don't even exist in families. And that's not the kind of creature we are. And we can't think that we can live these atomized lives without terrible consequences. And those consequences are what we're seeing.
I'm surprised at how infrequently I see in the mainstream press and in the kind of national conversation a reflection on the problem of a society in which pushing now between 40 and 50% of its children are being born to non-intact families. That has got to have a profound impact on those children growing up as to what they assume about the nature of life. From the very beginning, they assume that they are not initiated into a certain fundamental trust that the family is there to help them learn, to adapt, and to become what they were created to be. They have a much greater sense of the universe being broken than certainly I did when I was growing up.
You're absolutely right, Al, to zero in on that word trust, because that is what so many young people lack for the reason that you say. It's because they didn't learn it at home. So what happens when you don't learn that at home? What happens when you don't have a reliable, loving network of people to whom you're related, you know, people who have your backs? I think what happens is what we're seeing. What happens is identity politics.
Yeah.
What happens is a frantic flight to these collective identities, being whether they be, you know, sexual identities or identities based on race or ethnicity or feminism or other political kinds of identifications. The reason for this increasingly frantic search for the self in a group is that people don't have a secure sense of self growing up anymore.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's why isn't this sending off alarm bells throughout the society on this?
Well, of course, there's a lot of resistance out there, because in order to address the root cause of our misery, we have to look at the sexual revolution and what it has done in the world. And very few people want to take a hard look at that. One way I think of it is that the sexual revolution has become like this great big party. It's out of control,
yeah.
And we're now at the point where it's 2 o'clock in the morning and somebody has to call the cops, and nobody wants to do it.
The other day I received a review copy of a book called Full Surrogacy Now, Feminism Against Family by Sophie Lewis. And the book actually has a quote in it: where pregnancy is concerned, let every pregnancy be for everyone. Let us overthrow, in short, the family. So here we have kind of the logical conclusion of this idea that we are not family. So because there is no traditional, what we call nuclear family, we somehow have to be all family, which of course will mean we're children of the state. But this, she's arguing for the elimination of gestators, by which she means traditional mothers. And she's looking forward to new technologies to sustain the human race as we go further. And it's published by, it's not published by a wacko press either. It's published by Verso, which is a respected but radical New York publisher. Where pregnancy is concerned, let every pregnancy be for everyone. Let us overthrow the family. That's pretty far down the line, isn't it?
It's pretty far down the line. And it also gets me back to what we know about every other animal on Earth. We know from experiments on rhesus monkeys that when you destroy the family of the monkey, essentially you destroy the baby with it, because
yes.
Monkeys need other monkeys
yes.
to do their monkey thing. And, you know, the odd thing, Al, is that you could make this point about monkeys or elephants or other creatures, and everyone would say, well, sure, you know, you can't take those creatures out of their family. You can't take them out of their community. But we don't apply that insight to ourselves.
Right.
And especially in the case of the sort of argument you just referenced, what in the world are people thinking when they think that they can do this to our species?
Right.
What do they think is going to become of those children? You know, somewhere beneath arguments like that, there is a cold-bloodedness
yes.
That speaks volumes.
I agree. It's actually a frightening book in that regard, because it's not, that cold-bloodedness is not recognized by the author. Elephants are no longer in the circus, right? Because we've learned something about how elephants are supposed to live.
Yes, exactly. Again, what an irony we find ourselves in. We've learned that elephants are intensely social creatures who suffer greatly when they are separated from their families. This is one reason why they aren't in circuses anymore, and why campaigns to save the elephants get a lot of sympathy, you know, from across the
sure.
political divide,
yep.
because they're magnificent creatures who have to live in families in order to be happy.
Right.
We understand this when it comes to the elephants. But how much more so does this apply to us, to human beings? That's the connection that hasn't been made out there, and that's part of what I'm trying to do with this book.
You also spend a good deal of time looking at the survival strategies of various groups. So, you, for instance, the feminism has a survival strategy, androgyny has a survival strategy, and identity politics. Explain how feminism is a survival strategy in the face of this problem.
Well, the image I want people to conjure is the image of feminism on parade the way it was during the inauguration of President Trump. You remember the so-called resistance descended on Washington, D.C., and there were all of these women marching in the streets, you know, bearing the feminist banner.
Mm-hmm.
And the language was very coarse. The aggression was manifest. So what I'm trying to get at here is something that I don't think is very well understood. Why are feminists so angry? And I think part of the answer is that, in a way, they're right to be angry because they are living in a world in which elemental human connections have been severed, in which reliable men are harder to find, marriage is harder to find. They don't have, in many cases, brothers, cousins, fathers, loving male figures in their lives.
Mm-hmm.
And this anger and this bellicosity, I think, is coming from that place where it amounts to protective coloration, to acting like males in a world in which males are disappearing from women's lives.
Interesting. That's fascinating. Hold it there if you would, Mary. We're going to continue on the other side of the break. Primal Screams, the name of the book. How the Sexual Revolution Created Identity Politics. This is a profound volume, and we'll have it available, of course, for you. I'm Al Cresto.
When a U.S. Catholic hears the word mission, they envision priests, brothers, and sisters in foreign countries. Father William Bishop, founder of Glen Mary Home Missioners, realized that vast regions of our own country, primarily Appalachia and the South, were in need of Catholic missionaries too. Glen Mary is a Catholic community of priests, brothers, sisters, and lay missioners serving Mission Land USA. Come and see if God is calling you to be a Glen Mary missioner. For more information, visit glenmary.org. That's glenmary.org.
Hey, Bill. I was looking at retiring soon, but I don't know what to do about filing for Social Security or what to do with my 401k.
Jim, you should call Joe Vitale at American Retirement Advisors. He helped us roll over a 401k to Catholic values-based investments, as well as helped us with our Social Security planning to maximize our benefit. You can give him a call at 855-756-5700 or go to his website at aradvisorsinc.com.
If you believe in the power of prayer, Ave Maria Radio invites you to look at their website to submit a prayer request at AveMariaRadio.net. Your prayer requests are shared with hundreds at the Dominican Sisters of Mary, Mother of the Eucharist, the Servants of God's Love, the Monastery of the Blessed Sacrament Cloistered Nuns, the Family of Faith Apostolate, and the staff of Ave Maria Radio. Just go to AveMariaRadio.net and click on the Community tab to submit your prayer request today.
Hi, I'm Al Cresta. The Catholic faith has enemies. We're Catholics. We have enemies. They are a danger to the faith. And yet we're called to defend the faith, to instruct the ignorant, and to love our enemies. These enemies abuse divine revelation. They abuse science and religion. They abuse our history and our past. They abuse power and wealth. We have to learn how to deal with our enemies by picking up a copy of my book, Dangers to the Faith. You can find it online at AveMariaRadio.net.
We recently filed a civil rights lawsuit in federal court in the U.S. District Court for the Northern District of Oklahoma against the city of Tulsa and its chief of police for unlawfully firing one of its police officers because local political activists complained to the city about conservative social media posts the officer had made several years prior to his hiring as a Tulsa police officer. In a cowardly act of political correctness, the city of Tulsa and its chief of police fired a good officer because local left-wing political activists complained about certain Facebook posts allegedly made by our client 3 to 6 years prior to his hiring as a police officer. These activists play the race and anti-Islam cards every chance they get because, quite frankly, They hate white, conservative, Christian police officers. It's a shame that the Tulsa police leadership was so willing to throw the officer under the bus to appease these radicals. While the Tulsa leadership might side with these anti-police activists, I can assure you that the rank and file do not. As set forth in the lawsuit, it is well settled that the government cannot condition public employment on a basis that infringes the employee's constitutionally protected interest in freedom of expression. Our lawsuit alleges that the city's firing of the officer violated his rights protected by the First and 14th Amendments to the U.S. Constitution. We are seeking damages and attorney's fees. I'm Robert Use, co-founder and senior counsel for the American Freedom Law Center, bringing you this Faith and Freedom Minute. You can learn more about the American Freedom Law Center and its fight for your faith and freedom by visiting our website and liking us on Facebook.
When the need for senior care arises, home is where the heart is. Visiting Angels provides home care for mom or dad up to 24 hours per day, including personal care, meals, and light housework. You may select your professional caregiver with Visiting Angels. More information at visitingangels.com or at 877-374-LIVE. That's 877-374-LIVE. Visiting Angels, America's choice in senior home care.
The best.
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 Best. Best.
The Preston in the Afternoon Countdown.
Number four.
Good afternoon. I'm Al Cresta. With me is Mary Eberstadt. She is author most recently of Primal Screams, How the Sexual Revolution Created Identity Politics. Back to this idea of feminism as a survival strategy. Let me see. There's something paradoxical about this, and let me make sure I have this right. Feminism's attempt to demonstrate the power of the woman, the strength of the woman, the substitute, almost a substitute clan of the woman, the sisterhood, is in fact a symptom of the breakdown of trust in the virtuous male. Am I wrong?
No, you're not. I think what the sexual revolution has done is to make it less likely for many modern women that there will be protective male figures in their lives, whether those be fathers, husbands, brothers, cousins. This is partly just a matter of arithmetic. The family has shrunk, and simultaneously, it is often broken.
Mm-hmm.
So what happens when women don't have people like that in their lives? One point I make in the book is that there's a great irony before us, Al, which is that in some ways, this generation of humanity is the most sexually experienced.
Yeah.
The post-pill generation of humanity is the most sexually experienced in the history of our kind.
Mm-hmm.
But it is simultaneously the most sexually illiterate. And what I mean by that is not having the kind of day-to-day experience of the opposite sex that you would get in the time when families were intact, when people had large extended families, when they had numerous siblings, when they learned about the opposite sex in the context of a safe familial environment. And I think part of the frenzy that we're seeing out there, part of the anger that women who are feminists direct at men, is coming from a place of a kind of ignorance about our own species. And I find that fascinating, although, of course, it's also very sad.
Yeah. I agree. This So feminism grows up then, in many ways, as a protective strategy against the failure of the male. How is androgyny a related survival strategy?
Well, this too is a very strange thing that is peculiar to our time. In the book, I spend a chapter going through the various forms of evidence for the claim that androgyny is on the rise because of the sexual revolution.
Mm-hmm.
So there is the example of how a toughened feminism, a tough sisterhood, operates as a substitute clan, as you said, for the family. And at the same time, I think it's a world in which men are rewarded or have enhanced cultural incentives for behaving in a less masculine way. And just one example would be if you consider the fact that in most situations of divorce, the mother has custody and the male child is in a very difficult situation, no matter how heroic his mother is.
Mm-hmm.
Because the child can't help but get the message that men are bad,
right.
Men are transgressors.
Right.
Toxic masculinity is a phrase that is unique to our time. We didn't used to think masculinity was toxic. So my argument is that these and other subtle social cues amount to giving the message, sometimes subliminally, that boys will be better off if they are a little more gender ambiguous, if they are a little less like stereotypical boys. And that's just one example of the ways in which the sexual revolution changed our cultural incentive system. And I think this way of looking at it accounts for some of the things that people find otherwise inexplicable out there, like what's going on with the explosion of gender identities? What is that about?
Yeah.
Again, I think what it's about is its deep connection to the sexual revolution and changes in the way the human animal lives, radical changes that are having some that are bearing some pretty strange fruit out there.
How is this being picked? I mean, we're all the about a generation ago, all the rage was what was called sociobiology. And now I think that's not quite the term anymore. I think that they talk about evolutionary psychology now. But the idea was that we were learning from the lower species here. We were learning truths about how they lived, even ideas of family that you would find in lower animals. Why is it? How come that lesson isn't picked up and championed by some of these people who are, been so big on the lessons we can learn from the animal world, social lessons that we can learn from the animal world? Aren't these people, don't they see the problem that you're describing here?
Well, I think a lot of them don't see it, Al, because they don't want to see it. If you take a step back and ask, why is it that the whole world is obsessed with identity? That's not a question that most people want to ask, but it is what unites a lot of the phenomena of our time. All over the place, suddenly, it seems, a lot of people want to know, who am I? Now, why didn't it occur to previous generations to ask that question?
Yeah.
The answer, I think, is we knew who we were. We knew who we were when we could say, I'm a mother, I'm a grandmother, I'm an aunt, I'm a cousin, etc. The building blocks of human identity are relational, and they have to do with the family. And for a modern proof of that, just consider what happens when people get their hands on 23andMe or, you know, these other technologies that'll tell them what's in their DNA.
Yeah.
Well, it seems to be happening that fairly often there are surprises in there, and when people get their hands on this stuff, they want to know who they are related to, and sometimes surprise cousins pop up, people they didn't know existed to whom they're genetically related, and there's a great search on for this way of answering the question, who am I?
Yeah.
23andMe proves that we answer that question by talking about our families.
Hmm. You write about this question, who am I, as one of the most fraught of our time. It has become like a second skin, something that can't be sloughed off or even scratched without excruciating pain to the subject. And that becomes, of course, what you're exploring throughout this book. Now, I would have thought, you know, I would have hoped that this Me Too movement would have raised in everybody's mind that men are supposed to be responsible in this area of sexual expression. Instead, it seems as though we've lost the ideal of what men should be and made the assumption that all men are probably in some way culpable of these kind of transgressions. Why aren't we learning from the Me Too movement about what we've lost in the ideal of the man?
Well, I hope we do learn from it, and that's why I discuss it in the book, because I think there are important lessons there. Lesson number one, the world after the sexual revolution is not, in fact, a safe world for women.
Right.
And, you know, the assumption has been that now that we've leveled the playing field and we've got the pill and women can be just like men, women are therefore safe. Well, Me Too exploded that assumption, because here you have women, and not just any women, the women of Me Too are generally well-educated,
yep,
graduates of elite universities, you know, in media, in Hollywood, etc., and they were the very people being preyed upon. Now, why is that? Why were so many of them in harm's way? Again, I get back to the idea that it's because there's been a breakdown in social communication. They were never taught some very basic lessons, like don't go to your boss's hotel room at night, or observe propriety in other ways. And to say this, Al, is not to blame the victims.
Right.
It's just to observe that the idea that life after the revolution was going to be some feminist paradise has been traduced over and over again, and most recently in the example of Me Too.
Mm-hmm. Is this... do you see any evidence in the Me Too movement that leads you to believe that the lessons that you'd like to see learned are going to be learned?
Well, it's an interesting question. In a perverse way, I think we can draw hope from the fact that the social revolutionaries of our time are now turning on their own. This is what's happening with identity politics.
Right.
There are liberals who were once in good standing, who have been sent into ideological and social exile for daring to question anything about identity politics. So you have this kind of forever war in which each victim class tries to outdo the other ones.
Right.
And that's obviously not sustainable. But my question is, why is this happening? Why is identity politics so irrational and irrationally expressed? If you look at the demonstrations, some of the things that I talk about in the book, it's clearly pre-political. It's pre-rational because, again, identity politics is coming from this place where people have been deprived of being able to construct their identities in the normal human way. They've been deprived of family. So it's a hard message, perhaps,
yeah,
but I can't help but think that over time it will sink in on some people, especially as they watch the irrational doings of identity politics and as more and more people worry about what that means for our society.
Yeah, I hope that it's a lesson to be learned. I think certainly Christian communities, parishes, churches, families need to be aware of this conflict that's going on, because we need to live more transparently the virtues that we espouse and this understanding of the family that Catholics in particular have learned, especially from St. John Paul II in his theology of the body. We're out of time, Mary. Thank you once again. This is a profound book, and I'm looking forward to seeing it out there and people using it. Thanks.
Thanks so much for having me, Al.
Hi, I'm Al Cresta, and I'd like to thank you for helping us as we overcame the shortfall of our winter drive. And I want to remind you that our mission is to conform our lives to Jesus Christ and to equip others to do the same. Your prayers, your volunteer efforts, and your financial giving make you not just listeners, but partners with us as we try to live lives that evangelize, edify, encourage, educate, enlighten, and engage the culture. So together, let's build the church, and Christ will bless the nations.
Ever thought you'd make a bundle by trading in or selling your used vehicle only to find out it's worth a dinner for two? Well, it's much more valuable to donate your vehicle to Ave Maria Radio. Thousands of Americans donate their vehicle each year. The donation to Ave Maria is easy, tax deductible, and supports our efforts to evangelize. A year from now, will you remember that dinner or your gracious and selfless donation? Go to AveMariaRadio.net to find out more. That's AveMariaRadio.net.
Hi, this is Father John Ricardo, inviting you to join me as we explore some of the deepest questions that arise in our hearts, questions that shape the way we think, the way we speak, and the way we live. For all of these questions, Christ is the answer.
Our individual and corporate relationships with the Lord, our relationship to the church, the precepts of the church, our relationships with the world and the culture that surrounds us. Father Ricardo discusses these things and more, all from a Catholic perspective, on Christ is the answer. Listen to Christ is the Answer, Wednesday evenings at 8, Saturday evenings at 6, and Sunday mornings at 11 on 990 WDEO, 1440 WMAX, and AveMariaRadio.net on the Internet.
Christ is the way, the truth, and the life. He is the image of the invisible God. He points us to our destiny. He reveals the dignity of the human person. He is the one who makes known the Father. Christ is the answer.
It's time for Family Man with Dr. Gregory Popchuk.
How can parents raise faithful kids in a faithless world? A 50-year study of over 3,500 people found that the degree of parental warmth kids experience in religious households was the single biggest factor in determining whether children would become faithful adults. As I summarize in my book, Discovering God Together, The Catholic Guide to Raising Faithful Kids, children are most likely to become faithful adults when they've experienced the faith as the source of the warmth in their homes. The same study found that rates of faith retention in kids skyrocketed when religious dads took point on practices that contributed to a warm, faithful household. Things like generous affection, maintaining strong family rituals, and gentle approaches to discipline. God created parents to give kids a physical sign of His love. The more warmth our kids experience in our presence, the more warmly they'll feel toward the God who loves them through us. I'm Dr. Greg Popchuk. You can call me Family Man.
To discover more ways faith can enrich your life, visit CatholicCounselors.com.
Welcome to an Advanced Dentistry Center family. This is Dr. Metti, and our team strives to treat you like family in a loving and compassionate way as we focus on serving you in a Christ-like manner. We do this by emphasizing prevention and general well-being for a lifetime. Our private practice is small, personal, state-of-the-art, and innovative, with the goal to educate and motivate our patients in improving their oral health. It is through a partnership with you that you will achieve the goals for your smile. Advanced Dentistry is serious about the level of care we provide, with attention to details and an exceptional level of care, skill, and judgment. We are thrilled for the opportunity to serve you.
Dr. Matty and the team invite you to visit them at AdvancedDentistryCenter.com. Or call them at 248-594-9592. That's 248-594-9592. AdvancedDentistryCenter.com.
The best.
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 The Cresta in the Afternoon Countdown.
Number three.
Good afternoon. I'm Al Cresta. There are many questions that have arisen in the, I think it's over 3 weeks now, since executives of Central Ohio's Mount Carmel Health System revealed that they had fired a doctor for prescribing potentially fatal doses of painkillers to near-death patients in the intensive care units at two hospitals. Mount Carmel says that Dr. William Hussel ordered excessive doses of painkillers for at least 34 near-death patients, 33 at Mount Carmel West and one at Mount Carmel St. Anne's. All the patients died, though officials said they don't believe six of those patients died from overdoses. What in the world is going on here? There are now wrongful death lawsuits being filed against Mount Carmel Health and the doctor. He's been accused of ordering higher than level doses of, I think, morphine and fentanyl for more than 30 patients. My guest is Dr. Wes Ely. He holds the Grant Little Endowed Chair at Vanderbilt University School of Medicine. He's president of the Nashville Guild of Catholic Medical Association. He's intimately involved in the ongoing debate on euthanasia and physician-assisted suicide. And over at CNN.com, there is a profound and moving piece that he wrote, which is entitled, What Happens When a Patient Says, Doc, Help Me Die? Dr. Ely, thank you for taking time to be with us today.
Oh, it's my privilege to be here, unfortunately, for such a sorry set of circumstances, but I'm happy to talk about it with people because we can't get anywhere until we start having a real conversation.
Yeah, I agree with you. I was in 2003, I was hospitalized with necrotizing fasciitis. I lost my left leg above the knee. And they use a lot of morphine and a lot of fentanyl.
Yeah, that's a terrible disease. I'm really sorry you went through that suffering.
Yeah. You know, but I never worried. Going through this, I never thought twice about the doctors and nurses at St. Joe in Ann Arbor here. It never crossed my mind that they would not have my best interests at heart. I never thought that they would try to off me in any way.
And that's the real important thing, is that we have to be, the patient has to be 100%, not 99, not 98, certain, 100% certain that the doctor has their best intentions at hand in order to try and heal the person. Healing is the medical art. And once we introduce physicians being involved with taking the life of a patient, even if the patient asks, which in this case the patient didn't ask, but even if the patient did ask, physician-assisted suicide and euthanasia, it still is completely wrong-headed for physicians to be involved in prescribing lethal doses or administering lethal doses of medicines, because now you come in there with necrotizing fasciitis, and which doctor do you have? Do you have the doctor that wants you to heal, or the one who is at any time willing to see your life taken?
Right. How often do you come across this kind of thinking in fellow physicians? What is going on in this guy's mind?
Yesterday I flew home from a very prominent critical care meeting in Canada, and I was speaking on physicians assisted suicide and euthanasia, and the poll was taken in the room of who was in favor of physician-assisted suicide and euthanasia, and 80% of the doctors in the room were in favor of it being legal, which it already is legal in Canada, and 20% were not. So this has gotten to be a crazy rapid adoption from a secular and medical perspective, that people think, I want to be in charge of everything. The illusion of I want to be in charge, and they're switching the sentence from God is God and I am not into a sentence which reads in their minds, I am God and God is not.
Wow. There's always been a problem of a God complex among physicians, isn't there?
let's be clear here. There's no doubt in my mind that those physicians who said that they were in favor of it are doing it out of a sense of compassion and mercy.
Sure.
But it's a false mercy. They're thinking, I want to help this person, but it's a false mercy, because mercy involves diving into the chaos of another person's life and then lifting them up and providing healing. PASNE is diving into the chaos without any desire to lift or heal. It's essentially saying you are dispensable, and now that you have illness, whatever degree of disease you have, you're worth less than you used to be.
You've been asked to kill a patient, right?
Right.
What did you say to the patient when he invited you to help him die?
I said, look, you and I are in a covenant together. I am here to serve you, and we are in a relationship. It's an I-thou relationship. And I will never leave you. I'm going to stay with you. I'll be at your side. I mean, I don't mean that I'm going to physically be there 24/7, but I or the team of people here to care for you will be with you, and we are going to not abandon you, but we will not ever deliberately kill you. We will do everything we can to relieve your suffering. And then I started turning the conversation over to find out what mattered to him.
Yes.
Not what's the matter with him, but what matters to him. And we quickly go further into our relationship, and he found meaning and a purpose in his life, even in the midst of disease and suffering. And that's one of the things I outlined in the CNN.com piece, which people could just pull up and read. But basically, I'm there to serve the person. But that service doesn't mean doing anything you ask me if it's not in your best interest.
See, this. Tell us, what did he find meaning in?
It was really fascinating because he was an actor. He said, I'm a plumber, and I am an actor. He started quoting Merchant of Venice, the quality of mercy is not strained.
Wow.
And there was a nurse up there named Christine who was an actor, too, and she was in the theater, and she was having some life problems. And I said, Christine, why don't you go talk to him? Go talk to Paul, and you can find maybe you can provide him some help. But, of course, it went the other way around. Paul started helping her with her life things, and they developed a relationship as well. And a couple of days later, even though he was dyspneic and still dying, and we were doing everything we could to relieve his dyspnea and pain, of course, he said, you know, scratch that question I asked you. I need to be talking to Christine. People need a purpose.
Wow.
People need they have a purpose, but they lose sight of it sometimes. And this is ministering to somebody wholly, spiritually, mind, body, and spirit. And I did nothing, but relationship that developed between him and a nurse helped him find his purpose.
Wow, that's beautiful. What do you think is happening then with doctors in Canada? I would imagine in the United States, the number wouldn't be 80%, would it?
I think it would probably be more in the 50-50 realm.
Right, right.
The AMA and the World Medical Association still hold out a hard line against PASME, physician-assisted suicide euthanasia. But there are very, very strong forces trying to overturn that. What they're saying, by the way, is let's go neutral, as if neutral is not positive. The second you say neutral,
right.
What if I say to you, I'm not opposed to slavery?
Right, right.
If you're not opposed, it gets allowed.
Right.
But we know slavery is wrong, so we have to completely oppose slavery. And just because somebody says, I want slavery, i.e. they want autonomy to have that, doesn't mean we grant them that. So just because society says, I want control over the time of death, the real problem here, by the way, is I am not the judge of your decision of whether to live or die. That is your choice. And I am not imposing my judgment on whether or not you should be able to do that. What I'm saying, though, is society is only as great as its ability to protect its weakest members.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And as soon as we set up law to allow this to happen, the people who have no voice, the voiceless, the poor, the underserved, the mentally disabled, those who are uneducated, these people will be taken advantage of. And we've seen that
absolutely
in spades in other countries, Belgium and the Netherlands. And so we have to set ourselves up to protect those people, and that's why we can't grant this for anybody just because they ask it. There's multiple reasons on both the doctor's side and on the patient's side, but that's one of the first and foremost things that we have to stand up for. And religion doesn't drive that decision.
Right.
This is just about being human.
Yes. Years ago, I spent time with Jack Kevorkian, who was leading a crusade in favor of physician-assisted suicide. And from my conversations with him, I finally determined that really the arguments seem to come down to two different things. One of them is that we need to help people die because they are in such pain that it's, look, we would help, we would put our pets to sleep. Shouldn't we show at least as much mercy towards humans who are in intolerable and intractable pain? That's one argument. The other argument was simply the argument from autonomy. This person wants to die. Who am I to tell him he can't? Would you take the first one, the first argument, the mercy argument, which is we see somebody who appears to have intractable pain, they're willing to die, why can't we, quote, put them out of their misery? Go ahead.
Yeah, well, the first argument is related to mercy, and the thing that we absolutely want to provide is mercy, and we have to provide mercy. The question is killing somebody or is providing them a lethal dose, is that merciful? You do not have to provide somebody a lethal dose of medicine to take care of their pain. We are extremely good with good palliative care at providing control of those physical symptoms. We absolutely can't always control those symptoms, and there are times when we can't, but we can increase the level of the medications to the point of even unconsciousness without intending to kill.
Right.
It pivots on intent. Is our intent to relieve the suffering, or is our intent to kill? And as long as we stay on the side of my intention is to relieve suffering, then the principle of double effect covers us ethically in this circumstance.
Got you, yeah.
Because even if the medicine is elevated to the point of shortening life, as long as we were intending relief of suffering, that's ethically appropriate.
That's right. So the intent must always be to eliminate suffering, not the sufferer.
Yes, intent is to relieve the suffering patient, but not to it's to kill the suffering, not to kill the person
with
the suffering.
Right. Okay. And then, how do you respond to the simple when that argument? I've noticed that when the mercy argument is met, like you just did, then there's a fallback position, which is, well, fine, but listen, who are you to tell us that I shouldn't just be able to kill myself, or even enlist the help of others?
Well, then you're back on the autonomy thing.
Right,
Autonomy is one bioethical principle, but it is not the only bioethical principle. There are many others. Let's take beneficence for a moment. I have no doubt that the people who are wanting this intend to be benevolent, to provide good. But the question is it actually doing good? The difference between benevolence and beneficence. Beneficence is actually doing good. And so if we look at some of the other bioethical principles, autonomy is not the only one that we need to pay attention to.
Right.
And as I said earlier, just because somebody asks for something doesn't mean that it's the right thing for them.
Or that you're under obligation to do it, yeah. Dr. Ely, thank you. Great talking with you. I hope we can call you again on these matters.
Absolutely. Let's all pray together about this for the betterment of people and society and uphold of personhood and dignity.
Thank you so much.
Would you get on a plane that doesn't have a pilot? Investing in passive index mutual funds may present the same issue. The Ave Maria mutual funds are actively managed by seasoned investment professionals to help you meet your investment goals in a morally responsible way. Ave Maria funds are managed to conform to pro-life and pro-family values. Long-term investors could invest in the no-load Ave Maria Mutual Fund. You can learn more about the Ave Maria Mutual Funds at 866-AVE-MARIA or visit AveMariaFunds.com. Fire on the Earth's Peter Herbeck on the diminishing influence of God on our culture and ultimately in us.
One of the reasons why the church today is not having the impact it can have and should have is we've accommodated too much to the culture. Sunday has just become another day. The whole culture has just sort of transformed it and said, hey, there's nothing special about it. Now, the world is going to do what the world's going to do. But Christians have to be wise and not be conformed to the patterns of this world. That's a pattern in this world that's destructive. It's destructive because, one, it offends God, first of all. God says, keep holy the Sabbath. Keep holy the Lord's Day. And so many people have stopped going to church. Why? Because they're just busy. Why? Doing what? Playing golf, watching sports. Jesus loves our sentiments and our feelings, but he also looks at us seriously and says, do you seek to obey my commandments? Where are my commandments in your life? Are they a burden? Are you afraid they're going to take away your fun in life and are going to ruin your weekend? Do you resist them? Or do you hunger after them? Are they a light for your path?
Peter Herbeck spreads fire on the earth weekday mornings at 6:30 and again at 11:45 on 990 Ave Maria Radio.
Thank you so much for being with me. I'm Al Cresta. We are counting down the top interviews, commentaries, and discussions of 2019, and we are now to number 2. That's coming up tomorrow. Number 2, number 1, So make sure you're staying with me because it's going to be fun to go over those final two. Today, we had a good time with Tim Glimkowski, number six, talking about renewing parish culture. And again, I don't think there's anything more important for American Catholics than to find out how it is that parish culture is renewed. And first, above everything, the encounter with Jesus is foundational. And then we had Gerald McDermott on kind of an interview of whimsy, Moses and Stuttering, Mary Eberstadt on the primal scream of identity politics, and Dr. Wes Ely when a patient says, "Doc, help me die." Coming up as I go off the air, it's Jimmy Akin and Mark Brumley, an open forum on Catholic Answers Live.
Cresta in the Afternoon is a co-production of Ave Maria Radio and EWTN Radio, and carried across the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network. To follow up on any of the guests or information presented on today's program, visit the Cresta Guest Archive at AveMariaRadio.net. That's AveMaria Radio.net. To listen to this or any other edition of Cresta in the Afternoon, visit the audio archives at AveMariaRadio.net. Or to order a CD of the program, call 734-930-4506 or email orders at AveMariaRadio.net. That's 734-930-4506 or orders at AveMariaRadio.net.